From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week is the 15th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution. On today's Fresh Air, Jacanda Belli tells us why she joined the Sandinista underground and how she kept it a secret from her aristocratic family. Also today, Frank Langella on the demons that plague actors. Langella played Dracula on stage and screen and co-starred in the film Dave as the White House Chief of Staff. He stars in the new HBO movie Doomsday Gun about arms manufacturer Gerald Bull. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new film adaptation of The Client, starring Susan Sarandon and Tommy Lee Jones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations says she's seeking U.N. approval for a U.S.-led force to use all necessary means to restore democracy in Haiti. Madeleine Albright and the U.S.-led delegation are talking with U.N. allies about the proposed resolution. Meanwhile, more than 100 members of Congress say they want to be asked before the U.S. invades Haiti. Troops must first be approved by Congress. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
64 Democrats and 39 Republicans have signed a letter to President Clinton calling on him to seek congressional approval before committing any U.S. military forces in Haiti unless there is a genuine emergency threatening the safety of American citizens. Colorado Democrat David Skaggs is the principal author of the letter.
What unites us in this is quite simple. We believe the Constitution assigns to the Congress the power and the responsibility to decide on the use of military force if we're going to replace another government in another country.
The lawmakers say they consider the Haitian military regime to be illegitimate, that they don't question whether the president has honorable motives in seeking relief for the Haitian people, or that they would necessarily oppose a presidential request for authority to invade Haiti. But they say committing U.S. troops is a constitutional issue. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
United Nations officials say they can't cope with the refugee crisis in Zaire anymore. They're appealing to the world for help. The UN says it needs airplanes, pilots, and people and equipment to unload the planes. It also needs hundreds of trucks, water tankers, and crews to fix a road used by food convoys from Uganda to Goma, Zaire. That's the town where more than 1 million Rwandan refugees have fled to. President Clinton says he's ordered the administration to implement a plan to help the relief groups deal with a cholera outbreak. Administration officials say the U.S. will also offer another $35 million in aid to the relief effort. U.S. and Middle East bomb experts have joined Panamanian authorities in an effort to find out why a plane crashed earlier this week on its way to Panama City. All 21 people aboard were killed. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
According to Panamanian officials, American and Israeli experts have arrived in Panama to speed up the investigation of a mid-air explosion that destroyed a local commuter aircraft Tuesday afternoon, killing 21 people aboard. Preliminary reports by Panamanian police point to the detonation of an explosive device placed in the luggage compartment of the twin-engine aircraft. The tragedy, which occurred minutes after takeoff, has shaken the Hebrew community in Panama, since most of the victims were Jewish businessmen employed in the Colon Free Zone. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 9 points at 3,736. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The nation's first wind shear detection radar is operating today at Houston Intercontinental Airport. The system, system detects turbulence that's invisible to conventional radar and to the eye. It allows air traffic controllers to warn pilots of dangerous conditions. Wind shear was a factor in the 1985 crash at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. That killed 137 people. The new Terminal Doppler Weather Radar, as it's known, was developed in response to that crash. It detects sudden wind shifts within 50 miles of an airport and warns air traffic controllers instantly. Russia's greatest living writer, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, has arrived in Moscow for the first time in 20 years. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Russia's capital, Moscow.
Alexander Solzhenitsyn's special railroad car pulled into Moscow's Yaroslavl station tonight after a two-month journey that took him the 5,000 miles from Vladivostok on Russia's Pacific coast. 2,000 people were on hand to greet the Nobel Prize-winning author. Solzhenitsyn told the crowd that he had spoken with thousands of people along the way and that he found that Russia is suffering. Nobody thought it would be painless to leave communism behind, Solzhenitsyn said, but nobody could have guessed just how painful it would be. Solzhenitsyn returned to Russia in late May after 2 decades in exile. The Soviet government expelled him and deprived him of citizenship in 1974 after he published the Gulag Archipelago, a searing indictment of Stalin's labor camps. Solzhenitsyn says he has no plans to enter politics, but he has not hesitated to speak out throughout his journey about the shortcomings of the current government. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Officials in Buenos Aires say 39 people are now dead from a building explosion earlier this week. Rescuers pulled 4 more bodies from the rubble of a Jewish community center today. At least 157 other people were hurt in the blast. Argentine officials say search crews are looking closely in a basement area of the ruined 7-story building for more victims. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week marks the 15th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution that toppled the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua. My guest Jaconda Belli is from a family which was part of Nicaragua's aristocracy. But in 1970, she joined the Sandinista underground. In 1974, she went into exile. After the revolution, she returned to Nicaragua, worked in the Sandinista government's Ministry of Planning, and became spokesperson for the Sandinista electoral campaign. Belli now lives in Los Angeles with her second husband, an American journalist. She's a poet and novelist. Her novel, The Inhabited Woman, was just published in the States. It's about a middle-class Latin American woman who joins an underground movement to topple a dictator. As the novel begins, the main character doesn't believe her personality is suited to becoming a revolutionary. She thinks her personal rebellion against the status quo is one thing, but it's quite something else to get involved with extreme idealism and collective suicide. I asked Belli if she also believed she didn't have the personality of a revolutionary.
Well, my personal rebellion started by becoming involved in the Sandinista front. But I did feel scared very often. And the first time that I had to really officially commit myself, because I had been helping over, you know, a period of time, but there came a point where I had to make a more serious commitment. And I failed to go to the meeting. I had a meeting with somebody who was going to tell me what to do, and I didn't go to the meeting 2 times. I was so scared. And finally, the third time, you know, he called me and said, you know, you have to really, if you are serious about this, you have to come. Or, you know, if you're not, just tell me and we'll, you know, this will end right here. And I knew then that I had, you know, I couldn't put it off anymore and that I had to make a decision. And it took a lot of, you know, courage on my part because I was really very scared. But I felt very ashamed of myself, you know, for having been so undecided.
Tell us something about the family that you came from and the class that your family was part of.
My family is a mixed Italian and Nicaraguan. My great-grandfather came from Italy to work in the Panama Canal as a civil engineer. And one weekend, I think, he went to Nicaragua and met my great-grandmother. And that's how I came to be. And it's a family that has a lot of tradition in Nicaragua. It's considered very upper class, not necessarily very wealthy. You know, there are different branches, and I wasn't really a very wealthy person, or my parents weren't. But we had this name, you know, Belli. That was it's a very well-known name, and it's recognized as being one of the high society, families, etc. So growing up in that family meant that I had a lot of, you know, privileges, and I went to the best schools, I went to all the right parties, and I was a girl who was brought up to get married, to be a socialite. I was the queen of the country club, for example. And
the queen of the country club?
Right. You know, I don't know how to say it. It's not really queen in Spanish. It's novia, you know. They choose one girl who is a debutante in the year to be like the, you know, like the queen of the club. And it's quite an honor. and you get a, there is a ball given in your honor and all that. So I went through all of those rites, you know. I went through all of the presentation the in society and all those balls and meeting this all these boys, you know, that I was supposed to choose from, and they were supposed to choose me also.
When you were a young socialite, what was your impression of the dictatorship?
My first impression of the dictatorship was when I was very young. I must have been about 6 or 7. And I would go with my nanny to the store to buy candy. And there was a student that was killed very close to my house. And I remember seeing the blood on the door of his house where he had been shot by the National Guard. And I remember that image very well because it stuck to my mind. And I don't know when exactly my dislike or my disgust with the dictatorship started, but it was a chain of events. This person that I, you know, this student that I knew, that I saw his blood on the door. Then later on, we used to live next door to Violeta Chamorro's house, and I remember one night she coming and banging at the door of my house saying, you know, please, please help me. They have taken my husband prisoner. And that was when Somoza García, the first dictator, was killed, and Pedro Joaquín Chamorro was taken to jail. And so you see, all these things are memories that I have in my head, and that little by little, I guess, I decided, you know, this can't go on. I mean, year after year, things would deteriorate, and people would be killed more with more in cold blood, and nobody would do anything. I mean, it was just this feeling of impotence.
You followed part of your family's wishes. You got married when you were 18. You had your
right.
First child when you were 19. How were you introduced to the Sandinista underground?
Well, I was working in an advertising agency, and I started writing poetry when I was in my 20s. And through the poets and the people that I met once I started writing poetry, I learned more about the Sandinista front, because at that point, the only thing I felt about the Sandinistas was a quiet admiration, but also a lot of fear. I wasn't sure that they were right about what they were doing. And although I admire them for their courage, through these people, these poets and artists that I met, I learned more about the Sandinistas. I learned what their objectives were. I learned that they were really presenting an alternative for the situation in Nicaragua. And I met some of them. I met Camilo Ortega, who was Daniel Ortega's brother, who was later killed in the insurrection in Nicaragua. And we became good friends, and he told me a lot about the Sandinistas. So that's how I learned more about the Sandinistas, and I wanted to help. So I started to get involved very slowly. It was a slow process.
So what was the first work you did for the Sandinistas?
Well, the first thing I did was to take Camilo Ortega around, you know, to meetings and things like that. It was very small things.
This was Daniel Ortega's brother?
Right. And for example, I remember the first conflict that I had was when they asked me to draw a map of the house of the father of a very good friend of mine who was the director of a bank in Managua. And they said, we want to know at what time does he leave his house, when does he come back, what is his house like inside. And I it was the father of my best friend. So I was really, you know, I had a hard time.
Well, I can really understand why you wouldn't want to betray your best friend's father. So what did you decide to do?
I didn't do it. I told him that I couldn't do it. And since I was just starting, I said, you know, they didn't mind it that much. And they weren't going to do anything anyway. I think they were just trying to prove how willing I was to do something, or maybe they were just trying to prove my feelings, you know, how loyal I was. I never knew exactly what they were trying to prove.
Well, tell us more about the place that you found for yourself within the Sandinistas.
Well, for me, you know, life changed completely once I joined the Frente Sandinista. When I got married and I was so young, I was, you know, 18, and I remember thinking, well, is this it? Is this what my life is going to be? And feeling empty and feeling that I had much more to give than I was being allowed in my social milieu, and that I was condemned to manicures and pedicures and beauty salons and, you know, going to parties, and I didn't really like that. So I had this this dream of doing something different, but I didn't exactly know what. So once I got involved with the Sandinistas and I felt my life was useful, my life was going to be put to good use, I felt very powerful. As a woman, I felt very powerful. Because also I was starting to write poetry. I had discovered the how subversive poetry could be, because I wrote erotic poetry at the beginning, and I realized, you know, with the reaction that it caused in the Nicaraguan society, how subversive eroticism, when being spoken by a woman, could be. So all these things had given me a sense of power. And that completely changed the sense that I had of myself, of what I could do. Of also, you know, we had been brought up in our country to believe that we were impotent at the face of the dictatorship, that there was nothing we could do. And to realize that, yes, we could do something, that we could change our lives, that we could transform our destiny, that we had the strength in our hands to change the future. And, you know, that we were a group of people that we all believed that we had this conviction that was very strong. That also gave me a sense of belonging to a group of people that were much more worthwhile than what I originally belonged to by birth, you see.
Could you give us a sketch of the types of activities that you did?
I would drive people around. I would translate documents. I would hide weapons. That was, you know, basically, I would get people to give money for the Frente. We would hide correspondence that was going up to the mountains. We would sew it into different types of things, like a teddy bear, for example, or we had to look for ways to hide things, to send mail outside the country so that it would not be detected by the army. And later on, when I went into exile, I was part of the diplomatic political commission of the FSLN, and I was, you know, I, for example, brought had to smuggle all the weapons that were used in the October 77 attack in the border of Nicaragua. So I had a lot, you know, I did all kinds of things. I did things that I don't know what I don't know exactly what they were, because I had to travel to places and bring a bag, and somebody would come in the airport and take it from me. So I am not sure what I was carrying. I think it was probably money.
I believe you never told your husband about the activities that you were doing. Why didn't you tell him? Did he not believe in the Sandinistas?
No, he didn't believe in anything, in any kind of political involvement. He was very apolitical, and he wouldn't have agreed, and he would have made my life more difficult.
You think, know, he would have tried to prevent you from the actions you were taking?
Yeah, well, he tried to prevent me from going to the university. You know, at some point, mm-hmm. when I had just been married a few years, I said, I want to go back to the university. And he said, no, you are going to be, you know, you are going, in no time, you are going to be calling people to do strikes and things like that, so you better don't go.
So you must have been living a double life.
Oh, absolutely. I did. You know, I would, for example, hide all this literature from the movement up in the ceiling in my bathroom. I had a hiding place, and I would go into the bathroom and lock myself up, and that's where I would read all the papers and all the things that I had to read.
So were you still going to the country club, and people still thinking that you were a part of that circle while you were actually busy During other parts of the day, smuggling arms?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It gave me a sort of joy, you know. It was a funny kind of feeling.
My guess is Jacinda Belli. She was part of the Sandinista underground that overthrew the Somoza dictatorship 15 years ago in Nicaragua. Her novel, The Inhabited Woman, was just published in the U.S. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jacinda Belli. You fled Nicaragua in 1975. What made you realize that it was time for you to go?
Well, there had been a wave of repression, and the person I was working closest to was taken to jail. And so when he was taken prisoner, I realized that they were getting very close to me. And we had this rule that, you know, whenever somebody was taken prisoner, they knew that they had to remain silent for a week to give time for all of us to be able to find refuge and to, you know, to move around. Because you were tortured in such a way that you knew that at some point you were going to have to say something. So we all knew that. And when he was taken prisoner, we knew we had a week to flee or to, you know, seek refuge or go clandestine or whatever. So in that week, I left the country, and that was what we used to do.
Was everybody able to hold out for a week during the interrogations?
Well, that's what we assumed they would do. No, I guess not. Not everybody did, but, you know, in this case, he did. Mm-hmm. And he was buried up to his chin for more than a week.
In what?
In the ground. They buried him, this person.
So what happened to him after the week?
Well, then they took him out and they tortured him some more. And, you know, and after they thought they had gotten all the information they were going to get out of you, they would just put you in jail and not torture you anymore. That's what they used to do.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive. He's a psychiatrist.
So you fled the country. Your husband didn't know that you were a Sandinista. Did you tell him before you fled?
Well, I had to tell him because I had two daughters and I had to leave them with him. And so it was December 20th I had to leave. And it was quite difficult, horrible actually, because it was Christmas was coming and I couldn't explain to my daughters why I had to go. And I couldn't explain to anybody practically why I had to go. And I had to use a very frivolous excuse and sound frivolous and horrible. You know, that I was really tired, that I had to go and get a little bit of fresh air, that I needed to distract myself, something like that. And that's how that I had this ticket that I had to use. I invented that I had been given a free ticket and so that I was going to and spend Christmas in Mexico. But I had to tell my husband, what was going on, and my father and my mother, the three of them knew what was going on, really.
Was your family shocked?
Oh, they were very shocked. Yeah, they were very angry at me. They thought I was very irresponsible and that I was risking my life in vain, that...
Well, you were risking their lives too, in a way, I guess.
No, not really, because that was not the way the dictatorship operated. They didn't harm your family, especially my family, you know, being a sort of very well-known and high-up family. They were not going to touch it. So I knew that, and I knew my husband or my children were not in danger.
So how long did you live in exile?
3 years.
And you returned after the Sandinistas won?
Yeah, I returned the same day, the 19th of July, to Nicaragua.
What were your impressions of the Sandinistas after they took control over the government. Do you think that they did a good job in running the new Nicaragua?
Well, I think it was a very hard situation because the intentions were very good. I think we all started out with very good intentions and overjoyed by, you know, having conquered at last our, you know, our self-determination, etc. But with the, you know, with the intervention of the United States and this Contra war, etc., things became more and more difficult. There were also a lot of mistakes that the Sandinistas made, I think. Their rhetoric was too loud and unnecessary. I think machismo played an important part in the demise of the Sandinista revolution. I think it was machismo on the part of the United States and machismo on the part of the Nicaraguan Sandinistas. But as a whole, I think it was a comedy of errors. I think everything started going wrong, and you know, one, the war, the fact that there was a war led to less freedom. You know, the people who were more radical and wanted to be more lefty, more who wanted more something like more along the less democratic, let's say, had more room to operate because of the war. So it was, but I think, you know, for Nicaragua, it was a very democratic exercise, and the truth is that it was the Sandinistas who gave way to this new, to the government of Violeta Chamorro. I mean, by turning the power over to Chamorro once the elections were held in 1990, which is the first time in the history of Nicaragua that power has been turned over to the next elected president in a peaceful way. So I think it was very important to get rid of Somoza. I think the Sandinista 10 years were very important to also to build a new Nicaragua.
Were you shocked when the Sandinistas succeeded in overturning the Somoza regime? Did you ever think that would happen?
Oh, I thought it was like a miracle. I was shocked. Yes, I didn't expect it would happen so quickly, so the way it did.
And what about your parents? What did they think? They thought you were crazy and risking your life to join this revolutionary group, and then the group wins.
Yeah, no, they were very happy when the victory, you know, they were all, everybody was overjoyed in Nicaragua because everybody hated Somoza.
Your parents hated Somoza?
Yes, they did. My parents were, you know, from the conservative party. There were two parties in Nicaragua, the liberal and the conservative, and the liberal was the Somocista party and the conservative was the opposition. And my parents were very much against Somoza. And so everybody was overjoyed, and I was a heroine, you know. Once things changed, I was a heroine.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Gioconda Belli's novel, The Inhabited Woman, was just published in the United States. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the demons that plague actors. We talk with actor Frank Langella. He's not only been plagued by demons, he's played one, Dracula, on stage and screen. He played the White House chief of staff in the film Dave, and now he stars as weapons designer Gerald Bull in the new HBO film Doomsday Gun. And just in case John Grisham wasn't getting enough attention already, there's a new adaptation of his bestseller, The Client. Kevin Whitehead has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations is urgently calling for help with Rwandan refugee camps in Zaire. Disease and starvation are killing more refugees every day. The relief group Doctors Without Borders says 800 people died from cholera in the last 24 hours. The BBC's Roger Hearing reports from Goma, Zaire.
With the number of deaths rising fast, there's a growing desperation amongst aid workers that they're simply unable even to begin to deal with the problems of so many refugees. The emergency coordinator of the United Nations Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi, said he didn't think the current aid effort was meeting even 20% of the needs of the people here. He said it was an overwhelming task, and in his words, the ball was now in the court of foreign governments. They needed fuel and water, as well as people to run the airport, improve the roads and dig latrines, and it was all needed in the next few days. The lack of basic necessities is clear as cholera spreads, and bodies line the roads between Goma and the camps. The French army has sent lorries to one of the camps to bring out the corpses. Yesterday there were more than 300 cases. Doctors are predicting four times that number by the end of today.
Roger Hearing reporting. The United Nations has suspended its airlift to Sarajevo for the second time in as many days. Officials took the action after three planes, including an Air Force cargo jet from the United States, were hit by gunfire. A UN spokesman says one person was wounded aboard this plane. The UN had resumed flights into the Bosnian capital only this morning after suspending flights for half a day yesterday because another U.S. plane was hit by a bullet. The international airlifts have helped to sustain the Bosnian city while peace efforts to end the war go on. A new study is challenging claims that fear of malpractice suits makes doctors order billions of dollars in unnecessary tests and surgical procedures. Joe Neal reports.
For more than 20 years, doctors have been hit with a growing number of multi-million dollar lawsuits by patients charging medical malpractice. In response, doctors say they order unneeded diagnostic tests and perform operations such as cesarean sections just to avoid being sued. Now a new study from the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment concludes that doctors are exaggerating the threat. The report says fewer than 8% of all tests are done because a doctor 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 doctor.
We're having some technical problems. We'll return to the newscast as soon as we're able to straighten them out.
800 jobs over the next year and another 700 by the end of 1996. Company officials say most of the cuts will be made in Chicago, Houston, and Atlanta, largely from support staff, which are not directly involved in oil and gas production. Fuller says an entire layer of management is being removed so the company can stay competitive.
I don't currently have in mind another wave such as we're talking about here today, that given the competitiveness of modern business, we're going to have to continually worry about our cost structure. And so restructuring and re-engineering are sort of an ongoing part of our life, I think.
Ameco officials project the restructuring will save $600 million by the end of 1995. For National Public Radio, I'm Melba Gomez in Chicago.
Officials in the Italian parliament had to separate brawling Italian lawmakers today. They were members of the coalition government of Italian Premier Silvio Berlusconi. Observers say the scuffles point out the disarray in the coalition, which is made up of Berlusconi's Forza Italia party, the Federalist Northern League, the Neo-Fascist National Alliance, and two other tiny parties. Opposition deputies clapped as the fisticuffs broke out. The leader of the Labour Party says he gives Berlusconi's party 1 year at most before it collapses. The Islamic group Hamas is warning the Palestinian police commander against inciting a civil war. The commander has promised to crack down on extremists who attack Israelis. Palestinian police have arrested three Islamic militants in Gaza City this week and reportedly demolished a home used as a hideout. The trio were suspected of ambushing an Israeli patrol Tuesday and killing an officer. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's an HBO movie premiering Saturday called Doomsday Gun about Gerald Bull, the weapons manufacturer who was building the super gun for Saddam Hussein. Bull is played by Frank Langella. Langella was a star of New York theater in the 60s. He made his film debut as the good-looking con man in Mel Brooks's 12 Chairs. He became known as the most handsome Dracula in memory when he starred in the Broadway production and the 1979 film. More recently, he co-starred in Dave as the White House chief of staff. Langella has thought a lot about the demons that plague actors. It's the subject of a couple of pieces he's written for the New York Times. Years ago, when he was a young man starting out in the theater, he learned that even famous actors could be overcome by fear. He told me the story of the famous leading lady who had an anxiety attack in his car.
Oh, yes, it was a very well-known actress who... I was a very young actor, and we were on our way to rehearsal for the beginning of a new play. I had not yet achieved enormous success, and she was a great star, and I thought impervious to all of the emotions and feelings that I was having. And she vomited all over my car and then said to me afterwards, wait till you're up there, you'll see what it's like. Wait till you know what the prices are, how much you have to maintain what you've achieved. Climbing up the ladder isn't quite as frightening as being on top of it and trying to stay there. And it was just one example of all the many different demons, I think, that face actors.
Were you shocked to see that? To see that somebody, we'll keep her anonymous, but to see somebody of this stature being that nervous about maintaining her stature?
Well, it wasn't the first time someone has vomited in my car. But it was the first time anybody had because of a first rehearsal. I had not to that point ever known nerves of that kind or fear of that kind, and it stayed with me for a very long time. I must say it didn't resonate until many, many years later when there were elements in my own career I was either trying to maintain or recover or move on to. It just reinforced later on to me the simple humanity of all of us, you know? And again, the particular kinds of fears and terrors that beset people in my profession, I do not think that they are any more or less than any other human on the planet. I don't aggrandize actors' fears as, oh, well, we have it more difficult. As a matter of fact, I'm always angry with actors who complain about how they're not making enough money or the rigors of fame. That's absurd. But there are particular terrors that beset an actor that are quite different than other professions.
Well, what are some of those particular terrors?
Well, very often people become actors because they're frightened of themselves or frightened of what they feel when they're young and small, and they can't express themselves in ways that other people can. They're usually loners. They're usually have a feeling of either being crippled or somehow deformed or in some way less than. So they use characters and situations in which they can pretend to get away from that. You know, they use their false selves. And then the problem is that they get a great deal of applause for that, and they get a great deal of acceptance from their false selves. And as they grow up, their true self inside is saying, please let me out. I'd like very much to be recognized for my own value. And the false self keeps saying, well, be quiet, because no one's going to like you. They like me. And that, to me, is crisis, emotional crisis, when the false self and the true self are battling for possession of the person. And since actors receive a great deal of adulation, fame, money, success, all those things from their false selves, they have a bit more of a problem than the average person who's dealing with that problem.
But I think it's a really interesting way of looking at it, and I think that that perspective helps explain that really combustible combination of ego and insecurity that seems to plague not only just actors, but a lot of people in the performing arts in general.
Hmm, I agree.
So did you feel with yourself that you became an actor because you were frightened of your true self?
I don't know if frightened would be the word. Certainly dissatisfied, uncomfortable, unhappy with, not comfortable in my skin when I was a young boy. And I had a talent for it, you know. I had abilities as well when I was very little. So it isn't, you know, you act...
But insecurity isn't enough.
Yeah. You act in spite of your neuroses, not because of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kinds of demons come to haunt you, like right before a performance? Does that happen to you anymore? Were there stages of your career when it did?
No, I don't have those kinds of demons. I love to perform. I love to be in front of audiences. That's never been one of mine. As a matter of fact, in the early days, that's where I went to avoid the other demons. You know, someone once said to me, "Where do you go when you're most afraid?" And I said, "Center stage."
Why would being on stage chase away other things you were afraid of?
Well,
get your mind off of it?
You know, when you're very young, flight and running away from reality saves you. And then as you get older, facing reality right in the eye saves you. It's a very interesting difference between how youth and how maturity face things. I think, I shouldn't generalize, I suppose, but I will. When you're a young person, particularly a young actor, and you are beset with a great many terrors and fears, you run away from them somehow. Some people drink, some people do drugs, some people do sex, whatever people do to escape themselves and their fears. And then when you get older, your legs just get tired. Metaphorically speaking, you just don't want to run anymore, I think. You want to just stand still and say, whatever life has to offer me, I want to look it square in the eye and face it. And there's a kind of, I think, a sort of great joy and peace that comes over you once that happens.
Are the insecurities that plague you worse during periods of unemployment? You said the safest place for you is center stage. But in that period between films or between plays, when maybe you're home during the day when everybody else is either out at the office or out shooting a movie or something, do you get really edgy?
No, not anymore. I don't. I really do believe that if you don't find a way to get it together as you get older, you know, you're just cheating yourself. If you don't realize that wherever you are is where it's at, then you've got to shake yourself up and face that. And so I feel that way now. I feel... I don't think there's something around the corner, you know, waiting to make life better for me. I think it's all up to me. It's all sitting here in this chair now. It's there in my mind and my brain, and it's up to me to make the best of what life is giving me at the moment.
Frank Langella is my guest, and you can see him in a new movie on HBO called Doomsday Gun that premieres Saturday night. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll continue the conversation, okay?
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with actor Frank Langella, who stars in a new movie called Doomsday Gun, which is a story about arms designer Gerald Bull, and that premieres Saturday night on HBO. Did you ever worry about losing your youthful good looks and how that would affect your career or your public image?
Yes and no. I worried about it the way any man does as he's getting older. You know, you get grayer and you get heavier and you have to keep fighting all those things. And you see time chasing you in the mirror. But I also tried very hard to look at that and laugh at myself a little bit. I think I probably went through a period in my early 40s where I was not liking the change. And then I came to a time when I really began to enjoy it and see how much more was available to me as an older man on all levels. And in fact, I'm enjoying this period of my life more than my 20s and 30s.
For whatever it's worth, I'm finding I'm enjoying this part of your career the most.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I just find you really interesting to watch. Do you know a lot of actors who've tried to, like, cover up their aging, have plastic surgery and things like that, out of fear that they won't get parts if they don't?
Yes, I do. I also think, one of the most, as I say in the article you very nicely refer to, one of the most difficult things for an actor to do is to give up the thing for which he was initially loved. It's very hard for actors to, not as hard as a lot of other things in life, believe me, but for certain actors, I think it's very difficult to change. And in fact, to me, change is a great gift, both in life and in work. The more you change, the more you evolve, the more you give up things that used to work for you or you thought were your major calling card, the more you discover about yourself, the more exciting it is, the more interesting roles will be, because directors will say, well, look, that man can play this, that, and the other. He can look this way or that way. But I've seen too many actors younger than me and my age who say, I think they do it unconsciously. Oh, this is my look. This is what people like me for. So they run around pulling it all up or trying to maintain it, when to me it's very exciting to watch an actor evolve and change and look different. And he interests me more. If I go see an actor who's still stuck in his look, I think, oh, he knows he looks good from that angle. He knows this works for him. And then I'm bored with him because I think he's trying to manipulate me.
Mm-hmm. I should ask you about your performance as Dracula on stage and on screen. The movie version was released in 79, but before that you'd played Dracula in the Edward Gorey production on Broadway. Was the Dracula story a story that you had been much absorbed with before doing the movie and show?
No, not at all. I wasn't a fan of the genre or even that familiar. I doubt I had read Bram Stoker's book. I sat down and read it when the offer came.
It's a great book, isn't it?
It's a great, great book. A great, great book. Never fully realized, in my opinion. Never. Mm-hmm. It's maybe impossible to do. It's just a great book.
After reading the book and, you know, I don't know if you watched other movie versions of it or not, what did you want to bring to the role that you thought would, you know, be different than what had been done before?
Well, I honestly didn't have a set of goals. I rarely do. I sit down and read a play or a film script and think, can I play this part? And then if I think I can, I set about the small steps towards hopefully realizing it one day. But I don't have a big goal like this will stand for. I didn't really know that Dracula was going to become so successful and such a hallmark in my work. I had no idea. I just thought it would be a fascinating thing to try, and I knew that I wanted to stay as far away from Lugosi as I could. Mm-hmm. So I, in the rehearsal process, I was floundering, as indeed I always am in rehearsal. I regard it as a kind of wonderful, vast wilderness, the rehearsal process. And I just kept thinking, don't do Lugosi, don't fall into any traps. So I just kept putting it off and letting it gestate inside me. And then he began to develop, and I began to have enormous regard and respect for him. And I still do. I feel very, very close to and fascinated by this man who has been maligned so often in films and in so many ways. He's a wonderful, wonderful character, brilliantly drawn by Bram Stoker.
I know you grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey, which is an industrial area right near Manhattan. And your father owned a steel drum reconditioning business. Do I have that right?
Yes, he did.
Did he want you to go into the business ever? And did you ever want to go into that or any other kind of business?
Yes, he wanted me to go into it very much, and no, I never wanted to. I wanted very much to be an actor from a very, very young age, and I have a brother, an older brother, who was very interested in my father's business, and lucky for me he was, because some of my father's disappointment, I think, about my not going, and it was taken over by the fact that my brother was so willing to. And my father was immensely... you know, I promise myself that I will get through any interview I do without the use of the word supportive. And I was about to use it, and I caught myself. I'm so proud of myself.
That's a good rule to have. I applaud you.
Thank you. He was very generous and supported me, financially supported me, for the first 3 or 4 years of my career, which was really, for me, extraordinarily wonderful, because I was able to really choose and hold out for things when I was a young man that I probably wouldn't have been able to do had my dad not been so generous.
When you were a boy, did you have other friends who were interested in theater or in acting?
No, I had nobody, and I didn't know anybody. I came to New York really without a single contact or friend or anybody. I just, in that suitcase off the bus thing, just got off the bus and got myself a little one room. It wasn't even an apartment. It was a room on 109th Street and Broadway for, I remember it was $8.50 a week I paid to a landlady with a rabid dog. And I lived on 109th and Broadway for the first 6 or 7 months and, you know, did all the pounding pavement things.
Did you have a Jersey accent?
Oh, I had a very thick Jersey accent, yes. Very, very thick, and I just trained myself out of it.
How did you do that?
I listened to records. I listened to Gielgud records, and I remember listening a lot to Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady, which I eventually played just a few years ago. And I just listened and listened and listened and mimicked, and then probably in my early career I was probably a little too grand and English-sounding, and then I tried to moderate that.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you, I think. Thank you a lot.
For me as well, Terry.
Frank Langella stars as weapons designer Gerald Bull in the new HBO movie Doomsday Gun. It premieres Saturday night. This is Fresh Air. There's a cholera epidemic in the Rwandan refugee camps in Zaire. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have several stories. The estimates could be as high as thousands of people dying there. Michael Scholder reports from the camps in the town of Goma in Zaire, describing being in a field of dying people. Richard Harris tells what happens when cholera attacks and the various ways to fight it. Other stories, Joe Palca has more on the comet onslaught hitting the planet Jupiter. The United States in New York is asking the United Nations for authority to use all means necessary to restore democracy in Haiti. Also, letters from listeners about the politics of abortion.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Client is the third movie in the last year, adapted from a novel by former defense attorney John Grisham. It follows The Firm and The Pelican Brief. Critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
The TV ads for The Client tell us that a child has witnessed a murder, which is pretty shoddy because it's a blatant lie. It's not what the boy saw, it's what he heard that counts. Young Mark Sway is the kid who knows too much, specifically about the activities of a gangster named Barry the Blade. The FBI wants Mark to tell all so they can put the blade away, but there are two complications. Mark, who lives in a trailer in Memphis with his dim bulb mother, for the first time in his life possesses a marketable commodity, one he can't afford to sell cheap. Also, as lawman Tommy Lee Jones explains, kids always lie to adults. He doesn't mention that's because adults, like him, always lie to kids. Luckily, Mark finds himself a good lawyer, Reggie Love, played by Susan Sarandon, who's so wide-eyed she squints to register surprise. She's just the sort of person the FBI's good old boys would underestimate, but the way she tells off the fellas is the stuff of defense lawyers' fantasies.
Kid has a bruise on his left cheekbone. We found a spot of blood on Clifford's ring. Not his type.
Well, let me guess. Mark Sway's blood type.
That's right.
And how did you obtain Mark Sway's blood type?
From his brother's hospital admission records.
And how did you obtain his brother's confidential hospital records?
Well, look here now, Miss.
No, you look here. you get anywhere near my client again without my permission, I'm going to sue you and the FBI for civil rights violations. I'm going to file an ethics complaint with the state bars in Louisiana and Tennessee, and I'm going to haul your ass into court.
It's remarkable how easily you slide into sympathy with Reggie and her surrogate son as they stonewall the feds, even though it does mean they're keeping a killer on the street. As Mark, Brad Renfro, in his first screen role, is one of that new breed of non-hammy child actors. He's very good, as is Sarandon, who has the smart and vulnerable thing down. You also sympathize with him because all the nominal good guy cops are played by actors who are often cast as sleazebags. Tommy Lee Jones, Anthony Heald, J.T. Walsh, William Sanderson, and Will Patton. The movie of The Firm caught hell for screwing around with the plot. Not a good idea when 60 gajillion people have read the book. The movie of The Client rips scenes and dialogue from John Grisham's bestseller, but does a better job than the book of manipulating basic information, usually by withholding it longer. It's more or less the same story told more efficiently, for one thing because the movie doesn't keep repeating itself the way the book does. It also combines a couple of characters to give us a lot more Tommy Lee Jones, which is never a bad idea, and it makes Reggie younger and more explicitly maternal. The show starts fast with a terrific scene in the woods where Mark learns that guilty secret. It's oddly reminiscent of the graveyard business at the top of Great Expectations. But by the end, the story deteriorates into action better suited to Nancy Drew than our smart lawyer and her client. Mark and Reggie scurry over a transom, hoping the bad guys won't look up. Maybe that opening scene is really too good, because it makes the client peak way early. Nothing in the summation is as forceful as that opening statement.
Kevin Whitehead is an arts critic based in Brooklyn. He also reviews jazz for Fresh Air. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Jewel Bracey and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Summer Reading, we feature interviews with a couple of authors on the current bestseller list, spy novelist John le Carré and detective writer Walter Mosley. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.